The first reading is taken from the book of Psalms, Psalms 32. The joy of forgiveness. Happy are those whose transgression is forgiven, whose sin is covered. Happy are those to whom the Lord imputes no iniquity, and in whose spirit there is no deceit. While I kept silent, my body wasted away through my groaning all day long. For day and night your hand was heavy upon me. My strength was dried up as by the heat of the summer. Selah. Then I acknowledged my sin to you, and I did not hide my iniquity. I said, I will confess my transgressions to the Lord, and you forgave the guilt of my sin. Selah.
I have gotten used to providing a little featurette before the sermon. Some of you remember going to the movies and there's always a short subject before the main movie. I went when there were cartoons, but it's the same idea. This little advertisement is called Truant. Our high school principal ran his finger over two manila folders on his desk labeled with our names, my girlfriend and me. We were called to his office for skipping school. The day before, we ditched gym and history to chase the clouds on our bicycles. We sped down country roads, through the trees outside of town, wind blowing our hair everywhere, our heads empty of current lessons and careless of future plans. We stopped on a dirt road to hear the cries of a flock of crows on their way to lunch, to smell the sun on the grass swaying in tune. On the other side of the fence, a big green tractor was drawing straight sets of parallel lines across a field. We ate the oranges we'd intended for the cafeteria. Now, years and years after that lesson in practical geography, I remember the words of the principal and how right he was when he said, "This will become part of your permanent record." I remember this with snow blowing silently across my driveway, the days too short for anything but the business of getting on, the list of do this, get that. I remember this with a stack of unopened invoices for services rendered. But may it also be written how I skipped out in order to live in. New Testament lesson is from Matthew chapter 7. Toward the end of the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus gives warnings about false prophets and tells the people not to judge them, the false prophets, that is, by their fruits, what they do, not just what they say. Then he adds this, "Not everyone who says to me, 'Lord, Lord,' will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only one who does the will of my Father in heaven. For on that day, many will say to me, 'Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name and cast out demons in your name and do many deeds of power in your name?' Then I will declare to them, 'I never knew you. Go away from me, you evildoers.'" The word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. My brother Rodney always considered himself the white sheep of the family because while the rest of our herd was Presbyterian, he had seen the light and attended an Episcopal church. When he was in high school, he'd walk the mile up the hill to the Church of St. John's on the Mountain. St. John's on the Mountain sounds like a nice little country church, and it was. It had a small stone sanctuary dating back to the early 1900s with an addition of more recent vintage. It was and is in the country. Burnersville still only has 9,000 people spread across 17 square miles. But St. John's on the Mountain also had the highest per capita budget of any church in the diocese. And the nice two or three dozen people who regularly attended the services there insisted on what is commonly called high church. High church people, especially those in denominations where the liturgy is very important, have a whole vocabulary for their church lives. It starts with the personnel. The priest is usually a rector or sometimes a vicar. Above them, bishops, addressed as the Right Reverend, and head bishops, called the Most Reverend. The cathedral is run by a dean and assisted by one or more canons. Lots of administration, lots of forms, lots of ceremony. Brother Rodney, after attending for a few years, became a teenage acolyte. He took care of all the usual stuff, including lighting the candles, arranging the altar, parading in the crucifix, swinging the censer, that's the stuff that the incense comes out of, bringing in the communion elements, generally lots of details. Well, it's sort of a day like today in Burnsville, chilly in winter, and the boiler up at Old St. John's had been working hard making steam for the old-style radiators in the sanctuary. Rodney got there early, snow to be swept off the walkway and the stairs salted, the candles lit, the bulletins to be fetched, and the lovely communion set, a silver tray with a silver-lidded silver plate with shortbread wafers, a silver wine ewer, and a large silver cup to fill and drink out of. A nice white embroidered covering made of linen, and so on. All of those things, by the way, have special names, but we'd be here all morning if we had to learn them. Suffice it to say that one of Rodney's chief tasks was, at the proper time, to fetch the communion set from the back of the sanctuary and bring it up the aisle to the table in front, to the altar. Because he was particularly busy that morning, and because the table at the back had somehow gotten covered with literature and other things to be handed out, he didn't have time to clear it off right then, so he just set the communion tray down, temporarily, on top of the radiator nearby. But with all the hustle, he became otherwise occupied and didn't remember to reposition it. After the opening music, the prayers, the hymns, the anthems, the readings, and the sermon, it was time to celebrate the Eucharist, the Lord's Supper. While they're singing the preparatory hymn, Rodney, with measured paces, goes to the back to get the tray. The silver tray is not on its table. It's still on the radiator, which is very warm. He goes to grab it by the side handles, but he can't. They're too hot. So he looks around, can't find anything to use, and pulls down the sleeves of his robe and uses them like potholders to pick it up. Slowly, he brings it up the aisle. But now in the cooler sanctuary, the tray is putting off a little steam. A little cloud works its way heavenward as he processes. His head and his eyes are down because he just knows correctly that the priest sees what's going on and is looking very intently at him. He still has his chin on his chest when he puts the tray down on the table, takes off the linen cover, and then slinks off to the side. The elements on the tray, the bread and the wine, are now visibly steaming. The hymn ends. The people sit down. But all eyes are on the altar, and all minds are wondering just how this is going to work out. The priest, of course, has a little liturgy to go through for both the bread and the wine, but as he removes the silver bread cover, more steam is released. He decides to enter the Eucharist liturgy with a long and breathy prayer. Finally, he runs out of things to say and has to proceed. He uses his sleeve as a potholder and raises the bread plate for a blessing. Then he has to pour the wine into the chalice. As soon as the wine exits the silver pitcher, more steam is released, and the highly ornamented silver cup is now only a few degrees below boiling. Now, the priest traditionally takes a piece of bread and eats it. Fine. The bread isn't quite toast yet, but it is toasty. But then he's supposed to take a swig of the wine. This is a challenge, and no one could say for sure whether the priestly lips ever touched the rim, but the betting would be again it. When the people come forward to the communion rail to receive the sacrament, every single one gingerly took a piece of bread, held it, dipped it very gently into the top millimeter of the wine, blew on it, and ate it. It was a testimony to their faith, Rodney later reported, that no one refused to undergo the ordeal. Still, being warned in a dream, Rodney cleaned quickly and slunk home by another way. Now, there's another church, however, in Ocean County, New Jersey, about 55 miles southeast near the shore. In that area, the older, more established houses of worship only struggled, but there were more Christians than ever, due partly to overall population growth as people moved south from the more densely occupied urban areas, but also because of new independent, mission-minded evangelical churches who were terrific at attracting new members. The church I serve there was founded in 1845 when the town was at the edge of a ritzy vacation area. It had about 275 members. Ages ago, when he was in town, John D. Rockefeller, the oil guy, occasionally worshiped there. We have pictures. Sadly, the church was not included in his will. Oh well. About 5 years before I arrived, a new church started up on the northeast edge of town. Let's say it was called the Promised Land. Promised Land had 1,250 members, an auditorium that would hold 1,500, and a substantial recreational and educational wing. We referred to it as the Big Mortgage Church. But here's what happened one Sunday morning in the multimedia sanctuary with a 60-person choir, organ, piano, and brass. It was Advent. And during the service, they asked for the attendees to bring up their gifts for the county food bank. Gifts not of money, but of food. Canned vegetables, pasta, that sort of stuff. Well, with 900 or so people in attendance, the stage was pretty well covered with cans, and not just cans of pumpkin pie filling that hadn't been used the week before. The organist had to play two extra rounds of the offering music to provide time for all the donations. It was an amazing sight, according to my source, a friend whose daughter had opted for more contemporary architecture and rigorously evangelical theology. But there was food all over the place. Generous people motivated by faith and love. It was a beautiful sight. The daughter stayed in the sanctuary after the service, helping to sort the food for the transport to the distribution center, county seat, maybe 10 miles south. a sort of scruffy man with dirty jeans wandered in the back. There had been no one at the door, so he just walked right in and headed for the lights and the activity. He was halfway down the aisle before someone noticed him, although he wasn't trying to be noticed. He carried a beat-up black backpack, obviously containing some clothes and maybe a light blanket. He approached the stage and the busy food packers. "I see you're collecting food," he said. "Is it for the hungry?" "It's for the county food bank," someone answered, thinking more of the immediate destination, not the ultimate one. "The food bank in Tom's River." "I don't have a car," the man said. "Well, you know, there are buses that go right down Route 9, said another, trying to be helpful. "They run all the time." "Well, I get pretty hungry myself," the man said, more as a matter of fact than an outright plea. "Well, you know, the food bank is open on Tuesdays and Thursdays," another said. "I'm sure they could help you out. You see, this food goes there to the food bank." A voice from the back said, "Maybe the food bank will let you make a withdrawal," and then an insincere chuckle. "I just thought," the man with the backpack started to say, then stopped. "No matter. I can see you're busy. Sorry." And he turned around and walked slowly back up the aisle. Finally, a first-hand account I heard from a friend at a seminary conference on pastoral theology a few years back. Man runs into my friend, the minister of the church, in the grocery store, and after some quick small talk, he says, "Didn't you say in a sermon that God never abandons us?" My friend says, as he smiled, "Yes, I think I heard that in church somewhere." Smiles again. Guy says, "Yeah, but sometimes it's really hard to believe it, because it's not always easy to see." A pause while he decides that he's going to talk about it. "You know Jack, your brother?" the minister asked. "My brother. Haven't seen him in years. He only lives one town over, but we had a kind of falling out. He borrowed some money he said was for medical bills, but I found out he used it for a new Jeep. When I pointed that out to him, he blew me off, told me, 'So what? You can afford it.' Something like that. So that was it for me." My friend said he was quiet for once, but he could see that something was up, and he silently prayed God would make it known to him. "I'm sorry," he said. "Me too," said the man, resolute but bothered. A week later, when my clergy friend was visiting a parishioner in the hospital, who'd he run into but the bitter brother? He was standing by the door to another room. "Hey there," he said, then pointing to the room. "Someone you know?" "My brother. He's sleeping. He's in real trouble, they tell me. So I guess I sort of had to stop in. Nurse said he's sleeping. He's gonna die here. I just know it." And then he stops, turns, and says, "Remember we agreed that God never abandons us?" "Yes." "Well, where is God now?" "Huh? Where?" He wasn't really accusing, but he was questioning the whole idea of God's presence. Where's the comfort for him now? Maybe it was an accusation. But in his eyes, there was a real question, a middle-aged, angry man seeking understanding, trying to reconcile what he'd been told about the faith with what he was actually experiencing. "God never abandoned your brother," my friend said. "You have to go in. You have to. God sent you to forgive him." I didn't give you the endings of these three stories, but there are endings. The man with the backpack had just reached the vestibule of Promised Land when he was hailed by a worker coming from the side, carrying a shopping bag and an envelope. "We saw you come in," she said, "and I'm glad we caught you before you had to leave. This is for you," handing him the heavy bag. "And this too, it's a bus pass, just in case you know someone who might need it." The man standing outside the hospital room, he turned slowly, stared into the gloomy room for a minute, took a deep breath, dropped his tightened shoulders, and went in. And Rodney? He walked back up the hill to St. John's that next Sunday, understandably nervous about his reception. He was already confident he'd no longer be able to serve as an acolyte. How could he, after what he did to the Holy Sacrament? When he arrived half an hour early, he got really nervous. Most of the small parking lot was full, and normally people didn't arrive until 3 minutes before 11. When he opened the door, he was greeted by Mrs. Pine, the ranking member, and a bunch of her cronies. Before he could say a word, she opened her arms wide and embraced him. "Oh, we are so glad to see you," she said. "You know, we all make mistakes. That's why we're here." Jesus told the multitudes, "Not everyone who says to me, 'Lord, Lord,' will enter the kingdom of heaven, but the only one who does the will of my Father in heaven." Good lesson for the start of a new year in this community of faith, or any other, for that matter. Amen.